Welcome to another edition of Lying on the Beach. I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And today our special guest is Sam Roberts. He is the urban affairs correspondent of the New York Times. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, the New Republic, Vanity Fair. And to commemorate the 40th anniversary of New York City, Sam recently wrote a book called A History of New York in 27 Buildings. The book isn't really about design. It's really about how the occupants have used these buildings over the years. And Sam looks at Grand Central Station, the Empire State Building, St. Paul's Chapel. Other structures in his book show how municipal politics, also known as corruption, have impacted the department store, live theater, public housing, and more. And I wish you all could join us right now in welcoming Sam Roberts to Lying on the Beach. Welcome, Sam. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve and Lois.
Thank you.
And I think my first question is going to be a little bit about, tell us about yourself, and then why did you write this book? So, Sam, tell us a little bit about
I grew up in Brooklyn, was editor of my high school paper, college paper, and went into journalism for two reasons. One, I was always curious about things that I saw. I thought we, you know, took too many things for granted that we just saw in the street. And I wanted to know what was behind them. And frankly, working at the Times, I sort of get paid for getting a postgraduate education for satisfying my curiosity. And then another thing was that in daily journalism, we seem to think that things are happening for the first time. And I realized that what we need more of is context and perspective. And that's what history does. That's what history provides. I don't know how many people have seen the Alan Bennett play, The History Boys, but one of the kids in that play, one of the students is asked to define history. And he thinks for a minute and he replies more or less, well, history is one damn thing after another. Well, you know, that's one definition of it. I prefer George Orwell's definition, which is, you know, who controls the past controls the future. History is very important to us in the present and the future. And if we don't know where we came from, how are we going to figure out where we are or where we're going? And that's why I think history is so important, and context. And that's why, you know, in the books I've written, I dwell on history, not wallow in it, but dwell on it, because I think it gives us a sense of where we are today.
And this latest book, the one we just talked about a moment ago, how does that put things into context? How does that really give us, you know, what do you hope readers take away from A History of New York in 27 Buildings?
Well, I did a book on New York people called Only in New York, and I did a book on objects, artifacts, called A History of New York in 101 Objects, and I did a book on one building, Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. Then I figured, okay, let me try looking at an aggregation of buildings. And could you look at the 400-year history of New York looking at a number of buildings together? And I realized that, you know, buildings are not just brick and mortar. Buildings are built by people. They're built by people for a purpose. Winston Churchill said that, you know, we shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us. And what I discovered is that in looking at these buildings, these are mini biographies. They are, you know, stories about buildings. They come to life. And what I tried to do is infuse them with life. I picked buildings that still exist, and I tried to pick buildings that you won't find on postcards for the most part, you won't find in tourist guides, and that are quirky and that are trying to transformative in and of themselves, or representative of some kind of transcendent era that people wouldn't ordinarily think of, that they might pass every day on the street and take for granted and never realize how much influence or impact they have had on the city's history.
So, Sam, when people buy your books, because it sounds absolutely fascinating, you know, the whole concept of it, what do they get out of it? You know, go ahead.
Well, I hope what they get is, first of all, have a good time. because I want to make history fun. If I don't have fun writing the book, I can't expect people to have fun reading it. I want to make people think about history, think about New York in different ways. And what I've tried to do in looking at a history of New York in 101 objects, a history of New York in 27 buildings, is make people understand this is not the definitive list. This is my list. It's very subjective. And what I try to do is encourage people to come up with their own lists, to make them think about what they would do under similar circumstances, what they would include, what they think, how could I possibly have left out the Chrysler Building or the Woolworth Building or the old RCA Building? Why did I put this in or leave that out? To think about the city and about its history in ways that we didn't learn it in school, where we learned dates and places and names by rote, but realizing that history is about storytelling, it's about a narrative, that it's much more interesting told that way to grown-ups and to kids than in many cases the way we were forced to learn it, and that it tells us so much, such richness about who we are today and why, and again, about where we're going as people.
I love you for saying that, because I was never a great student. But if I had a teacher that told a story or put things in the proper perspective, I excelled in that class. I was like head of the class. And what you just described was just a dream trip for me, because it kind of like gave validation for who I am today and why
I'm not. One of the stories in the book, Lois, is about the South Bronx. The South Bronx is the poorest neighborhood in the country. And until 1985, there was a nondescript factory in the South Bronx that virtually nobody knew about, but it was called the American Banknote Building. It was a printing plant, and that printing plant was churning out billions and billions of dollars in currency.
Oh my!
You know, just billions of dollars, not millions. And it was right there in the poorest neighborhood in the country, and nobody knew it was there. And just that juxtaposition, just that contradiction, I find absolutely fascinating. And it's one of those quirks, one of those fascinating things about New York that almost could only happen in New York. And it just tells so much about the diversity, the dichotomy of the city, and how little, in a way, we know all about it when we think we do. And I thought I knew a lot about the city. I've been covering it for 50 years for the New York Daily News and the New York Times. I thought I knew a lot, but in researching this book, I just learned so much more.
How did you decide which 27 buildings then? Because there are so many iconic buildings and so many great stories. How did you decide the 27 you were going to focus on?
Well, I had a couple of criteria. One, they had to still exist. So unfortunately, that means I had to leave a lot out that I would have otherwise included. The old Metropolitan Opera, for one, Ebbets Field, certainly for another, and buildings like that to me were iconic, the old Madison Square Garden. So they had to exist. They had to be in some way transformative or, as I say, representative of some kind of transformation in the city's history. They had to be not obvious. So, yes, the Empire State Building is there, Grand Central is there, but for the most part, they are buildings you would not find in a tourist guidebook, you would not find on postcards. They had to be surprising to people, surprising, frankly, to me. And the truth is, why are there 27 buildings? Because, honestly, I miscounted. There was supposed to be 25. I wound up with 26. And then the publisher, Bloomsbury, said, well, as long as you've got 26, could you please include the Flatiron Building, which is where we have our offices? And the Flatiron Building is just such a gorgeous building on Broadway. It looks like it's the prow of a ship, you know, just steaming up Fifth Avenue, that I said, of course. So, frankly, that's how we wound up with 27.
So, Sam, how did you get the content that, like, most people don't know about and may not be written anyplace? How did you discover, you know, most of the astonishing things that you have in your book?
Lois, I love to do research, and to tell you the truth, research comes to me a little bit more easily than the writing. I started going to the kind of people who actually like talking to reporters, to journalists, and that's archivists, curators, librarians, historians, and saying, you know, what would you include if you were writing a book like this? And I got many great suggestions. When I was writing the book, A History of New York in 101 Objects, I was also looking for quirky kind of things and wrote one article in the Times and appealed to readers, and they came up with great ideas. Times readers had, you know, suggestions that I never would have thought of. So, you know, people have terrific imaginations and people are great resources thinking of things that I never would have thought of. And then a lot of reading, frankly. There are books like Stokes' Iconography of Manhattan, and they're, you know, rich history books that are almost forgotten. And if you do that kind of reading, if you go back to old newspapers, if you go back to architecture history books that are out of print, you find these things that you just never know existed. Manhattan has the only building in New York City in which a president was inaugurated. We, of course, have Federal Hall, which is the site of where George Washington was inaugurated president in 1789, when New York was the nation's capital. Not that anyone knows that New York was the nation's capital. People have no idea that's true. But we also have a building on 123 Lexington Avenue, a townhouse, that was the home of Chester A. Arthur. And when James Garfield died of a bullet wound in an assassination, Arthur was inaugurated president at that house on Lexington Avenue. Now, it's now an Indian spice shop, and people walk by it or walk into it to buy spices and have no idea that that is the site where President Arthur was inaugurated as President of the United States. So there are all these wonders. There are these amazing history sites in New York where history actually happened. And again, people just have no sense and take for granted all these things that have happened are happening all around them. I find that just fascinating.
That information begs the question, yeah, how many hours of research did you have to do? How long did it take you to write this book? Because it sounds like you needed several lifetimes to get this done.
Well, Lois, I'd have to say countless. You know, I didn't use a stopwatch, and, you know, I was doing lots of other things at the same time, including
right.
my day job at the Times.
Right.
But I was having fun, so... You know, again, if I didn't have fun researching and writing it, how could I expect people to have fun reading it? And, you know, I didn't count.
What was it, a year,
sort of a
2 years?
I'd say probably about 2 years. But I was enjoying it all the time because it was a voyage of discovery. And I was satisfying my curiosity and imagine getting paid to do that. And it's something that I always enjoyed. I mean, one day I was walking down Fifth Avenue and looked up and something struck me and I thought the Empire State Building looked shorter. Now, I hate to admit that because this is, you know, a sign of obsessive compulsive disorder, I guess. But, you know, I went back to the Times office and I made some phone calls. And in fact, they had done some repairs to the antenna. And
right.
The Empire State Building had shrunk by about 30 feet. And this wound up as a front page story in the New York Times. Now,
I read
again,
that article.
I'm embarrassed to admit that I noticed that. But, you know, if you keep your eyes open and you're not constantly on your cell phone or looking at your feet walking, you know, on a Manhattan or street or in any of the other boroughs, you see things, and there's things out there to see. And in this city where things are constantly changing, where this New York is constantly recycling itself, this is a city of discovery, and I try to discover new things every day.
Sam, do you do a lot of traveling?
I do some traveling, but I've never been interested in becoming a foreign correspondent. I've traveled around the world. I've traveled around the country. but I've never run out of things to cover in New York. And wherever I go around the country, around the world, I keep coming back to New York. I've lived in New York all my life. I grew up in Brooklyn. I went away to college, but came back because I've always found more and more that surprises me, that piques my curiosity, and that I can write more and more books and articles about.
Sam, please, Sam? At this point, I think, Steve, you should tell us who he is.
Well, yeah, I want to shift gears a little bit because I don't think our listeners realize that Sam is not only a famed journalist and a New York Times correspondent for years, but what's really amazing is he's also a movie star. So we've kept that a secret till just now. But I saw Sam for the first time in the Roy Cohen documentary. Lois saw the movie separately and then told me who he was and that she knew him. And so, Sam, have you gotten a lot of recognition from the Roy Cohen documentary? And you're such a big factor in it. And how did it come about?
Steve, I'd say movie star is a bit of an exaggeration.
Well, maybe a little exaggeration. Okay,
but it is kind of amazing. You know, you can write for the Times and Daily News for 50 years, and then people see you on TV or in a documentary, and suddenly that seems so much more important. But yes, you know, I was interviewed when Marie Brenner and the people behind the Roy Cohen documentary, which has gotten great reviews, asked me to be interviewed because I knew Roy Cohen. And one of the ways I knew him was I covered him at the time, but I also interviewed him for another book I wrote called The Brother. And that was a book about the Rosenberg-Adams spy case. And it was based on interviews with David Greenglass, who was the brother of Ethel Rosenberg. And it was his testimony that sent both Ethel, his sister, and Julius Rosenberg to the electric chair. And I just found that family dynamic absolutely fascinating. I mean, here was this dysfunctional family, the Rosenbergs accused of espionage, David Greenglass actually a spy in the army at Los Alamos, these people thrust onto a world stage way above their heads, this couple from the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the early 50s, and then turning out, I think, to have been much more valuable to the Soviets as martyrs than they probably ever were as spies. And a case that still, when we're talking about civil liberties and national security, still reverberating today, as it did when the brother testified against them in the 1950s.
When you actually knew him as someone you would have lunch with him occasionally, what was your relationship like with Roy
Cohen?
Well,
he was a source. I would say he was a friend, or he was more of an acquaintance and a source, basically. Someone I spoke to for information. Fascinating person, an interesting lawyer, an amazing raconteur. Someone who wasn't particularly to be trusted, but had access to an incredible number of people, including Donald Trump, including lots of other movers and shakers in New York and around the country. He was really a mentor to Donald Trump in many ways.
Sam, what was it about him that people were so attracted to? I mean, a lot of people knew that, he was not quite upstanding. So why were they interested in being connected to him?
He was shrewd, more than anything. He was cunning. And he had certain, I wouldn't say principles because that sounds too high-minded, but he had certain tactics and strategies that if they didn't work, they certainly were appealing to people. I mean, his basic strategy was the best defense is a good offense. When people are attacking, you attack them back and attack them harder. And lots of people were intimidated by that. And if, other people knew you had Roy Cohen as a lawyer, they would shrink away. And that proved to be very effective to a lot of people, including Donald Trump. And the fact that you could scare people away just by saying Roy Cohen was your lawyer was a pretty big asset to lots of people. And he loved that. He loved to flaunt that and did it very effectively. Was he that great in the courtroom? Sometimes, yes. Although he wrote a book when he had defended himself not too successfully, A Fool for a Client, pointing out that you shouldn't defend yourself as a lawyer. But he was smart, more so shrewd and cunning, though, than smart.
So, Roy, at this point,
was he a pleasure? Was he a pleasure to hang out with? Was he? What did you feel? Make you feel at ease, very comfortable, or was he the kind of person that puts you at ill ease? What was it like just to hang out with him? Was it a good experience?
He was interesting. He was. He was the kind of person you might not have felt comfortable with, but he was fascinating to see operate, to see how his thought processes work, how he was going to figure out how to screw the next person.
That's interesting.
And he would he revealed that when you're actually just hanging out and talking to him? You could get that kind of strategy going on, or just as he told a story, or just as you watched him
operate
around?
Well, good point, Steve. He revealed it. How much of it was credible and believable is something else.
Yeah, because...
All right, Sam,
tell us
about your career, because people will be fascinated by it, and I don't want to lose, that content for this podcast.
I'll give you a real brief summary, because, as I say, it's lasted about 50 years so far. I was editor of my college paper at Cornell. I was lucky enough coming out of school at that time to get a job at the Daily News in New York, where I worked for about 15 years as a reporter, columnist, city editor, which was one of the great jobs of all time at a tabloid newspaper in the 70s, early 80s, when we were dealing with a serial killer called Son of Sam, when George Willig was climbing the World Trade Center, when there was a blackout in New York, when we had a dysfunctional team called the Yankees. Everything a tabloid editor could ever wish for in the best and worst sense of the term. And then in 1983, I came over to the Times and only wanted to be a reporter because that's what I enjoyed doing best. And over the years, got dragooned into various editing jobs and worked as a columnist, too. And eventually wended my way back to writing, which is what I'm doing now. I'm on loan at the moment to the obituary desk. Went over there to write advance obituaries, but frankly, people keep dying, so I haven't gotten to most of the advances yet. But I find that absolutely fascinating, because obituaries are really not about death. They're about people's lives, and they turn out to be mini biographies. And, it turns out that they're the only stories I've ever written about which I know the ending to. All the others are, continuums, and you don't know where they're going to wind up, but at least obituaries, I know how they're going to end.
And there was a documentary, speaking of documentaries, about the obituary desk at the Times, which was absolutely fascinating. So
it was terrific. It was done just before I got there, but Marguerite Fox, Bruce Weber, Bill McDonald, all the people who were in that did an absolutely terrific job.
I was hanging on every word of it. It was terrific.
Sam, that's not your only career. I've seen you on TV.
I have been doing the New York Times' program, first on New York One News, now on CUNY TV, since 1992. And believe me, the Times' attitude toward television has changed incredibly over those years. In the first, it began totally standoffish. And nowadays, video on nytimes.com and video on all sorts of other outlets is one of the things that we're doing best. We have a new program called The Weekly, which is on streaming on television, and we have learned to do it, and learned to do it, I think, very, very well.
So, Sam, I have to ask you this question, because I was in journalism for 12 years, a B2B journalist at Fairchild Publications, and then I started with my husband our own PR agency. And Steve and I deal with, hundreds of journalists, every year in different capacities, and most of them are starving today or out of work. What makes you, and how did you survive this ever-changing world of journalism and hiring kids at 20 years old. It may be a question that you don't want me to ask, but this opportunity to speak to you, there must be a profound answer to this.
Well, if there is a profound answer, I may not have it, but let me try two answers. One, I keep my head down and try to do the best job I can and have a good time. And, you know, let's say I've gotten away with that for 50 years. And second, I think this is a golden age of journalism, which may sound like a contrarian theory. I don't think it's a great time to become a newspaper boy, a carrier boy, but it is a great time to go into journalism because you could be discovered in ways that you never could before. Before, you'd have to work for some little paper, the Canarsie Courier, some tiny paper in a small town for X number of years, and you might move up to some bigger paper. Now, you can be on the internet, on the web, writing stuff that millions of people are going to see. Now, the competition is going to be greater because lots of other people are going to be doing the same thing. But if you're any good, you can get that exposure immediately. You can be seen. You can have that opportunity. And if you keep writing and if you keep polishing your stuff and if you're any good, you can make a name for yourself and you could advance yourself in ways you never could before. So I think this literally is a golden age for kids, for anyone, any writers who really want to start out and commit themselves to getting better and better and not giving up as writers and reporters.
So how has it changed your writing when, content gets into, all the social media quicker than it appears in the paper?
Well, it's made writers a little, reporters a little bit more like wire service reporters, before you were writing maybe once a day, you had a deadline at 5 or 6 o'clock on a newspaper. And now, frankly, it's more 24/7, because the idea is to get something online on nytimes.com as quickly as you can. You could make an argument, does it really matter to be online 1 minute or 5 minutes or 15 minutes ahead of everyone else? Someday we'll figure out whether that matters or not. We try to be right rather than first, but, we try to be right and first because at the moment that does seem to matter. And the one thing the Times has going for it that you won't find in many or most other places, not all, there are other places doing a very good job as well, is we have credibility, and we have news judgment, and we have experience, and we have a vast field and pool of reporters who are doing a terrific job, and we have not cut back on that. Lots of other places have cut back on staff, have cut back on other things to save money. We have not done that because it's not just altruistic. We have not done it because the one great thing we have to sell is our staff and our resources and our credibility and our experience. And I think that's what makes the Times different from everybody else.
What is the next book you're working on?
I don't want to, tell all, and maybe this is a spoiler alert, but this is going to be a story of the 400-year history of New York through not obscure buildings, but kind of obscure, quirky people who, for the most part, most readers will never have heard of, but trying to tell the story of the city's development, of the city's history, through people and their lives, and how those lives affected the growth, the history, the development of New York from a struggling Dutch company town into the world capital that it is today.
That sounds so fascinating to me.
You should be interviewing Lois. I think she's going to have to be interviewed for this.
So.
I had an influence here.
Who's the only person, the two
Lois.
Of you?
Okay. I think on that note, we can wrap this up. Are you in agreement, Lois?
I could talk to Sam forever, so we better stop now.
Okay, and I have to get to that Indian spice shop so I can see the inauguration documents and stuff to see that's really true. But on that note, Sam, thank you very much for joining us. This was all very fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
And I recommend everybody check out Sam's book and also the Roy Cohen documentary. And once again, I'm Steve Greenberg with
Lois Whitman Hess.
And we have been Lying on the Beach. So long.